Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you so much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. We kick off this new week with yet another weird law from around the world. We are running dangerously close to the end of the series. I think we'll see if we can get to the end of the month with them. But that being said, according to the Mad Houses Act of 1774, it is an offence to keep more than one lunatic unless you have a license. This has, of course, been repealed since, but speaks very clearly on the number of lunatics you are allowed to keep without or with or without a license. I suppose in-laws don't count, and that depends on where you stand with your in-laws. Nevertheless, we tune into the SFM Market Update with Manuel. And on the show today, we're going to be taking a look at the results from the likes of Calgro, M3 and Boxer. Both companies gave us an update on their first 6 months of their new financial year, and we're going to get a sense of how each company has performed. We've also got a conversation with National Treasury, taking a look at the Mzansi Exchange that they launched just late last week. Then we've got a conversation with the Just Energy Transition Project Management Unit within the Presidency to get an update on where we stand on some of the projects they have been responsible for. And then, because it is Monday, we've got a personal finance conversation. We're going to be taking a look at managing your finances as a blended family.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We kick off the show, as we always do, with a sense of how markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Director and Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, Gary Boyson, to take a look at market movements and see what we make of them. Gary, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Interesting start to the week in some respects. Some markets feeding off of last week's risk sentiment from President Trump looking to impose new tariffs on top of the new tariffs that we already had on China. China seemingly not backing down from that, and markets just saying, we don't want any part of this.
Yeah, so I think Friday, everyone was a little bit panicked. We saw big sell-off in the likes of the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 late into the evening. And I think everyone was expecting a Black Monday. But, you know, the rhetoric around the tariffs have it was dialed down a little bit over the weekend. And I think, you know, financial market participants are betting on the taco trade. Trump always chickens out. And you know, if we are essentially going to go back to a US-China trade embargo where, you know, we have over 100% tariffs levied by each nation, we've seen what that'll do to financial markets. We saw it after the Liberation Day tariffs, and you'd expect markets down around 20%. As it is, the markets are discounting it totally, and we're seeing a strong rebound. So we had the all-share index up just under 1%, but that was driven all by the gold miners. So the resource index up 4.32%, and, you know, lifted by the likes of Harmony up 7.38%, Goldfields up 6.82%, and the gold price at the moment now, I think with a little bit of nerves creeping in, you know, over $4,100 an ounce. So a lot of that move coming from our commodities. We had the industrials and the financials negative. So industrials down, call it 0.75%, and the financials down around 0.25%. But over in the US, it is Columbus Day. That doesn't mean that the markets are closed. Some bond markets and some OTC markets are closed, but both the NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange are trading. And we have S&P 500 up 1.5%. So the rebound really starting to take hold. The dollar is still a little bit firmer. So if I look at the dollar against its European trading partners, you know, up quite a lot. You know, emerging markets are also doing their fair share as risk on kind of seeps back into the market. So we've got the Rand dollar exchange rate from almost 17.50 on Friday evening all the way back down to 17.28 currently. I think everyone kind of waiting to see what happens. We do have earnings season kicking off tomorrow with some of the big US banks reporting, and earnings seasons are typically positive. So maybe discounting what's going to happen in the geopolitical front and just going to focus on what's happening with earnings.
Gary, I want to get into earnings season in a second. I've just noticed that the spot price of silver has gone above the $50 an ounce level there. Now, there has historically always been quite a unique correlation between the gold and silver price. Certain amount of silver equates to a certain amount of gold. And we did see a bit of divergence when the gold price started to move and the silver price wasn't keeping pace. But could silver now potentially be something that investors look to say, well, we didn't get in on the gold rush, perhaps we can get in on the silver rush? I see some very interesting developments happening out of certain central banks as well there.
Yeah, so it's interesting. There's a question I was asked last week as well. You're saying, yeah, I mean, obviously you've got the gold-silver ratio. There's clearly been a lag. You know, is silver, you know, going to be the next gold? Is that the precious metal that's going to run? And I mean, it's an interesting question because, you know, if you're looking at actually holding physical, obviously silver is a lot cheaper than gold. So one, if you are going to have to store the silver, you're going to have, it's going to take up materially more room in your vault, if you want to put it that way. But there are plenty of exchange-traded products that you can access. And it's something that, you know, silver was, the way I answered the question when I was asked last time was saying that, you know, gold has, you know, traditionally been the diversifying asset on central bank balance sheets. A lot of the gold rally that we've seen recently has come from the likes of China, which has been a steady buyer as it tries to diversify away from those dollar reserves. And we're seeing that across the board, all central banks picking up gold, but silver hasn't really been a central bank asset since the 19th century. So in the 19th century, central banks would actually hold silver. 20th century, no one paid it any mind at all. It really wasn't seen as a diversifying asset. But in the last couple of months, and I remember asking questions like, how come central banks don't buy silver? They buy gold. And that's why you've seen this decoupling. But there has actually been central bank buying of silver in the last couple of months. So Russia has been buying silver, and the Saudi Arabian central bank has also been buying silver, although they've been diversifying into actual silver miners and silver ETNs, so exchange-traded notes and ETPs, at least exchange-traded products. So yes, there has been a shift in central banking to say, wait a minute, this is another hard asset that we can hold instead of just holding foreign currency reserves. So could this be the beginning of a big silver run? Maybe it could. Maybe it could. Yeah, it's not something that I hold a lot of, but yeah, definitely silver up 3%, gold up 2.5%, and gold still running, but silver running faster.
Gary, let's move to those earnings. We know that typically earnings season in the United States, it kicks off with the banks, and we know the banks are set to kick off this week. But we also know that there has been conversations out of the White House to potentially say that we do this far too often in one calendar year, and perhaps moving to sort of an interim structure makes a bit more sense than doing quarterly updates. When we get that decision, we will get that decision because the US government is still technically in shutdown. But what does this earnings season hold for us? What are we looking forward to here?
Yeah, so I think it's going to be an interesting one. So typically in earnings seasons, what we've seen, the pattern in earnings season is earnings seasons are generally pretty positive for markets. But what happens is analysts, so the kind of consensus forecasts on where companies are going to report, generally falls into earnings season as you know, analysts almost downgrade their outlook. This is one of the first earnings seasons where this hasn't happened. And we've actually seen more upgrades from analysts than downgrades. So we're expecting quite a lot from S&P 500 companies this time around. You know, like the expectation is for an 8% lift in earnings across the board. That's up from 7.3% at the start of the quarter. So people are thinking this is going to be a pretty good earnings season. And you know, as much as we look at markets and think, could this potentially be a bubble? Look at the incredible run that we've had since kind of the lows of 2022. How much more can there be to go? This is something, you know, stocks are very, very, they almost 100% correlated over the long term to the earnings of the companies. So if we are to see a strong earnings season now, like that will go some way to justify some of the extended valuations that we've seen. And when I say extended valuations, I mean, that is a real concern around this earnings season. So if we look at a forward 12-month price to earnings ratio on S&P 500, that stands at about 22.8 currently. The five-year average is around 19. call it 19.9. 10-year average is at 18.6. So we're definitely operating in a market where people are prepared to pay up for equities. They're paying up for those earnings. They're expecting future growth. But this is the first time the consensus is kind of like bending in the same direction. And they're also looking for higher growth this time around. Does that mean that potentially this time around we're going to be disappointed? I mean, I suppose that's what we got to look at all the company results to understand. But, you know, the kind of sectors that we're expecting the growth to come from are clear, and they're the obvious ones. So, you know, eight out of the 11 S&P 500 sectors are expected to report growth. And that's, of course, going to be led by technology. It really is that AI theme that is still kind of bleeding through the market. Utilities and materials also up there, and financials also expected to do pretty well this time around. On the downside, you know, the three sectors that are expected to report year-on-year declines in earnings are energy and consumer staples. That's at least two that are expected to report declines, consumer staples and energy, seeing a lot more struggle, obviously, with the lower oil price that we're seeing now, certainly not helping things in the energy sector.
Well, lots to look forward to from an earnings perspective, but alongside that, markets seemingly getting back on the train and keeping the train moving despite all of the tensions that continue to prevail. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you, as always, to Gary for the time and for the insights. Gary Boyson, Director and Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, joining us to take a look at market movements and perhaps market drivers.
I think the family needs a break. We've always wanted a holiday home. Maybe we should see what's out there. Imagine waking up to an ocean view in a beautiful villa.
With a big braai area and a spare room for when family visits. If it's on your mind, it's on ours. Partner with a wealth banker will connect you to a home loan with up to prime minus 1.5%. See money differently. Nedbank Private Wealth. We're licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We kick off our interim updates with the team at Calgro M3. They released their interim results for the 6 months ended 31 August 2025 for the first half of their new financial year. We're going to be speaking to the company's chief executive officer, that's Ben Pierre Malarba, about the performance of the business. Of course, Ben returns to the helm as CEO following the departure of the previous CEO, rather, Vikas Latakhan, who left in December. So, Ben, thanks so much for taking the time. Lovely to have you on the show. I suppose welcome back. It's a bit of a interesting return to the fold, but it's always nice to have one of the founding members of the organization come back to continue to lead the organization. Ben, from a interim perspective, how do you and the team reflect on the first 6 months of the year, especially given the transition the business is in?
Jimmy, good evening. Looking back at the last 6 months, I think there's a mixed bag of feelings. The residential market hasn't recovered as expected. We normally see the recovery of the residential market 9 months after the interest cycle starts coming down. The interest rate cycle has been coming down very slowly, and we haven't seen the full recovery. Yes, we do see some green shoots. We've got the support from the financial institutions, but I think they're because of the high interest rates, our consumers are still under pressure, and it's delaying their ability to commit to the purchase of a house. Saying that, the investor market recovered quicker than we expected, and you see a big focus, or our focus, and the drive on that in that market is currently people buying these units for the rental market. So, yeah, it's the consumers are under pressure, but the market is still there.
Ben, is this consumer pressure giving you concern around the Bankenveld District City project? I know when I spoke to Vikas, and we've been keeping an eye on this from the Calgro M3 perspective, that project was set to be quite a big shift in how you now approach residential projects going forward. With the slowdown from a consumer perspective and understanding you have nothing you can do about that but wait for the consumer, is that giving you concern around that project, or are you still, I see that a lot of the capital that was being redirected towards other initiatives has been redirected towards the development of the project, so clearly you're still forging ahead with it.
Yes, Jimmy, we're definitely going ahead with that. I think the location of the project sets it apart from a whole lot of other developments out there, with its location close to the Sandton CBD and the Waterfall CBDs. I think if you look at Operation Vulindlela, where they say we need to get people closer to job opportunities, we can't afford people to spend 40% of their disposable income on transport. We must stop building at the outskirts and the peripheries of our cities and towns. I think the location is in our favor here. So even in a constrained market, I'm not too concerned about the Bunkenveld project as itself.
Ben, let's take a look at the Memorial Parks business. Clearly, the business doesn't need much discussing. It's trucking along as it should. It's contributing cash. It's doing exceptionally well. It's continuing to grow. That must be a nice to have when the business is looking at potentially saying, maybe we need to do a bit more on the residential side. It's nice to have a portfolio or an asset within the business that kind of just does what it needs to do and keeps bringing numbers through from a bottom line, top and bottom line perspective, I guess.
Jimmy, I think it's a great business to have at this stage, and it actually allows us to grow into big mega projects like the Bunkenveld project. We're looking at two different risk profiles, where the Memorial Park is not interest rate linked, has not got no public sector exposure, we've got predictable cash flows, and is generating cash. So we can afford to sit back and install and do the installations of the bulk infrastructure. We're currently busy with the road infrastructure, the stormwater, and the intersections that will allow us to develop at the Bunkenveld project. So, yeah, it's a great business to have at this stage.
Ben, before I let you go, I want to take a look at some other news that came out of the SENS announcement, some other developments that the business has been working on. The share buybacks, I want to get an update from that perspective in terms of just unlocking value for shareholders. It's increased net asset value per share by quite a significant amount as well there. But also the business's overall plan around reducing debt, restructuring debt, just optimizing the business. There doesn't seem to be a problem from a balance sheet perspective within the business, but that's not to say that the business hasn't thought, how do we make the numbers even leaner?
Yes, I think it's time to start unlocking value for shareholders. And one of the key pillars we identified is the sale of the non-core assets. And if we say non-core asset, that is a development we own with no intention to develop in the next 5 years. So we're looking at it and say, if we can dispose of the development and we can reduce debt in the medium term, we're still a cash-intensive business, so it's not going to be an overnight remedy. But if we can sell some of the non-core assets that we've got no intention to develop and reduce our debt, that will allow us to manage that relationship between our total debt and our market capitalization is something that we're currently looking at. So I think that will help. And then at the same time, balance the two businesses, the two segments. Like I said, two different risk profiles, but the Memorial Park business is growing, and it's a great business to have in a time when you grow into new projects, but at the same time also trade out some of the existing projects. We can't just look at Bunkenveld and say that's the next big thing, that's where all our focus is. We've invested a lot of money in infrastructure in our pipeline over the last couple of years, so unlocking that value and sharing that with or distribute that to the shareholders, I think that's also a focus from our side.
I was just going to ask, Ben, does that then make you a bit more optimistic going into the second half of the year, understanding that even if there is a bit of a lag on the consumer side, even if there are some other challenges, you have enough in terms of project pipeline to just keep you guys busy?
Yes, and I think that's exactly that. We've created opportunities for ourselves over the last two reporting periods where we serviced residential opportunities. We're currently not focusing on servicing opportunities. It's not the need. I think we've got sufficient to roll it out over the next 12 to 18 months. So, yeah, we're a lot more optimistic, and we would like to see more construction, more actual houses under construction in the period ahead.
Calgary M3 would like to see more construction and more investment into infrastructure, as they are doing for themselves as well. We'll see how the next 6 months shapes up from a business perspective. We look forward to catching up at the end of the financial year. All the best to you and the team, Ben. Ben Pierre Malarba, the CEO of Calgary M3, joining us to take a look at the first 6 months of their new financial year and what they are focused on going into the rest of the year.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
In a world where a lot can change in 6 years, you can rest assured that Hino's 6-year drivetrain warranty won't. All Hino trucks now come standard with a 6-year drivetrain warranty, protecting your investment all the way from pistons to gears. Built to keep your business moving, supporting uptime, growth, and daily operations. Because although a lot can change in 6 years, our warranty promise won't. Terms and conditions apply. Hino all the way.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Boxer Retail Limited released their interim results for the first 6 months of their new financial year. The 6 months ended 31 August 2025. Now, this is the first set of interim numbers for the business since listing in November of last year. We would have caught up around the end of year numbers earlier in this year, but for the new financial year, this is the first update of a 6 month kind. We're going to take a look at this with the Chief Executive Officer at Boxer, Marek Masojada. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of the performance. Marek, lovely to have you back on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. A strong start to the new financial year. Only your second financial year as a listed entity, but the business has continued to show some signs of improvement and signs of strength. What do you make of the first 6 months?
Good afternoon, Jimmy, and thanks for having me. Yes, we are very happy with the results that we put out to the market today, showing, you know, real strong turnover performance at up 13.9%, and probably the most positive number was the like-for-like sales achieved, where we grew our existing stores by 5.3%. So happy with the momentum that we've gained and built over the first 6 months of the year.
Marek, alongside the update from a financial perspective, operationally, the business has made a couple of changes. I see you introduced a new loyalty program, the Boxer Rewards Club. Take us through, from a grocer and from a retailer's perspective, where you're seeing value in things like the rewards programs, understanding the kind of market that you guys compete in.
Yes, Jimmy, we introduced our Boxer Rewards Club in about November of last year, and we've about to go through our 12-month anniversary. We've signed up approximately 2.3 million members who've joined our rewards club and are getting value back whenever they shop at Boxer. We have specific promotions where we reward customers according to their spend. And it's been a powerful mechanism for them to get more value back at Boxer stores. It also, from a company perspective, enables us to get information about consumer spending habits and patterns, which we've also seen some good value out of. So yes, it's a journey. We have about a quarter of our turnover associated with an individual shopping card or swipe, as we call it. And that's really opening up some insights for our teams here.
Marek, what are you seeing from a consumer perspective? I mean, Boxer operates in a very specific segment of the South African market compared to some other supermarket retailers out there. And I mean, you look to compete on product set, and Boxer has a little over 3,000 products within the product range that you guys offer to consumers. 2,000 of those are mostly foodstuffs. That doesn't give you much competitive advantage in a market that might have a grocer having 15,000, but it also might put you at an advantage because you could potentially provide your product set a lot cheaper. How are you seeing the South African consumer and what they're looking for from you at the moment?
Yes, Jimmy, interesting points that you've made there and spot on. Yeah, we operate very much in the value-conscious consumer segment of the market. And for that reason, you know, our success depends on our ability to offer customers best value at the till. We see our format, the discount format, as a powerful model of where we're able to use the simplicity of the model and also our absolute focus on those 3,000 lines to be able to really be experts in the way in which we procure and sell those products. And through that efficiency is what enables us to really compete in the market against the bigger players out there that might have a wider range than ourselves. I think our customers know us and trust us for these essential items that they depend on.
Marek, from a numbers perspective, the business saw an increase in trading profits. Margins, though, stayed exactly the same when compared to the first 6 months of last year. Margin consistency is not a bad thing, but it's always great to be able to see a headline figure grow, to be able to see profits grow, turnovers grow. It shows that the business does continue to maintain its momentum in a difficult environment.
Yes, absolutely, and that is our goal. I mean, Jimmy, just to unpack it a little bit, our trading profit, which is representative of our operational performance, increased by 15.1% over last year. So relative to our turnover growth of 13.9%, our trading profit increased at a higher rate. And I think that reflects the efficiencies and our cost control in our business. Our stable trading margin compared to last year at 4.1% was actually an excellent performance, because in the 6 months we absorbed some additional costs into our income statement as a result of now being a listed entity. There have been additional costs as we brought in certain functions, etc., in-house that previously were done by the Pick and Pay group. And we've been able to absorb those expenses through doing more turnover and volume through the business. I think the other thing just to note is when we go down to a headline earnings point of view is that on listing, Boxer took on some long-term debt. And obviously, there's a cost of interest that we've incurred during the 6 months, whereas in our base, we had interest earnings of approximately 60 million. So headline earnings grew 5% versus the trading profit of 15%. But it's largely as a result of the restructure that was put in place at time of IPO. As we move forward and as the company trades profitably, we've repaid 200 million rand worth of our long-term debt during the half. We intend on repaying down further debt, and we'll see the two measurements of headline earnings and trading profit now move more in sync with each other.
Reducing debt, but also keeping shareholders in mind with that maiden interim dividend of 45 cents per share. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Marek for those insights and for the time. All the best for the second half of the financial year. We look forward to catching up at the end of a strong year. Marek Masojada, the Chief Executive Officer of Boxer Retail Limited, joining us to give us a sense of the first 6 months of that business.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't, because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The government of South Africa, in its effort to better improve its systems and its service delivery towards South Africans, last week launched what is called the Mzansi Exchange. It is still in its pilot phase, but hopefully this new system and this new way of working will improve some of the data sharing that takes place between South Africans, South African government departments, and everyone else in between. I'm joined on the line by the Acting Chief Data Analytics Officer at National Treasury. That is Dr. Ayanda Hlatswayo, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Dr. Hlatswayo, thanks so much for taking the time. Lovely to have you on the show. What is Mzansi Exchange?
Thanks, Jimmy, and thanks for the opportunity to engage with you today. So simply, the Mzansi Exchange is a national data exchange initiative that is essentially created to integrate data or share data between different entities, supporting effective policy, planning, reporting, and service delivery. A great analogy to think about it is that it's like a railway network, but except for trains here, we're moving data. So data moves between departments and entities. It's not a central data repository. So the exchange itself does not store any data, which allows departments to retain ownership and responsibility of their data while enabling data sharing with other authorized entities when needed. That's essentially the Mzansi Exchange.
That's interesting, Ayanda, because you mentioned that it's not a central repository and it doesn't store information, because I was going to come to that later in our conversation. But let's take a look at just perhaps why the government felt the need for this. I mean, we have seen from a South African perspective that when different government departments need to verify different things, it can become quite a cumbersome process. Is that what spurred on the creation of this particular exchange? And is that what's driving the decision behind it?
So I think, yes, in part. Essentially, what this initiative tried to address is a number of challenges in the data landscape. So information in South Africa across government departments is often siloed, fragmented, with limited interoperability, making it difficult to access or share when it's required. So these challenges have constrained our ability to make evidence-based decisions, to deliver integrated services, verify applications, like you've mentioned, allocate resources more efficiently, and just to also build trust or public trust in government systems again, you know, by enabling data sharing in a safe and secure manner so that we're more efficient as a government in delivering services.
Ayanda, you mentioned that data has always come with problems, and I imagine some of those problems are not isolated to South Africa alone, but some of them seem to be quite prevalent in the South African landscape. I'm thinking about things like data breaches, data leaks, cybersecurity attacks. From an infrastructure perspective, and with what we aim to achieve with Mzansi Exchange, how secure is that going to be? Because if we're now dealing with even more data being exchanged, and we already have a security issue on some of our government departments having been hacked in the past and the likes of that, I imagine that when we build something like this, security becomes top of mind.
Yes, indeed. So what the exchange does is, in the analogy I was talking to you about, it's the same analogy we've been using even at the launch on Thursday last week, is that much like, you know, a train station when you need to send data, our train stations in the exchange environment are essentially security servers that connect this entire system. And the reason why it's not a central data repository is for that very reason. We don't want a single point of failure where if someone tries to attack the system or hack into the system, they then have access to all information. But each government department will have a security server which manages their entry and exit point into the system, allowing them or allowing us better control of what information is actually moving through that system, what is requested, what is received, that it's going to the right people. So there's a whole data management and security network that underpins the exchange, which is what we're currently piloting. So I think I must emphasize that we're in our pilot phase so that we can iron out and answer all of these questions by the time we move this to a full-scale system that is actually delivering and making all of the changes that we want. We want to have ironed out all of this internally.
What does the pilot phase entail? What are we looking to achieve by the end of the pilot phase? And how do we measure kind of the success or failure of the piloting phase to allow us to decide whether or not we move on with this? Or is this a project that will move on regardless, but we just want to make sure we cover our bases before it moves on?
Yeah. So I think with the pilot phase, what we'd like to achieve is a few initial key use cases that we've prioritized. We have four data sharing themes that we are testing during the pilot phase. So we need data to be able to move for verification as well as compliance, right? Reasons. So for example, by verification, I mean, we're using SASA as well as Department of Home Affairs, for example, in one use case where we're looking at real-time data exchange so that when you're onboarding a beneficiary, you're able to at real-time check if this is a person who's alive, this is a person who has a valid ID, and building the system around that. We also have data sharing for evidence-based and policy making. We have data sharing on open data platform. And then we also have data sharing for operational purposes within government departments. So, for example, this is data sharing between our financial systems teams, for example, and our procurement teams, so that, you know, we can make data sharing more efficient across these four different themes. That is what we're testing at the moment. Success for us is being able to do a successful point of proof of concept by the end of the year, improving as many data environments within different government departments so that those government departments are able to build APIs. They have data dictionaries and catalogs. They have the ability to maintain their security servers so that they can connect and exchange data on the exchange once we start to scale up. So I think it'll be a phased approach even after the pilot. I don't think that every single government department will be ready to be onboarded onto the system, but we'll have to have a tiered and a phased approach on how we upskill government departments to be able to onboard, to be onboarded onto using the exchange long term.
A new exchange built for efficiency and better data sharing within the Republic, aimed at bettering the lives of South Africans. It's still in its pilot phase, of course, folks, but we'll definitely keep an eye on this and see how it develops and when it will be ready for use by everybody else. Well, for now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to the Acting Chief Data Analytics Officer at National Treasury, Dr. Ayanda Hlatswayo, for taking us through the launch of the new Mzansi Exchange.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
South Africa has been on a transition path to become a cleaner country from an energy perspective as part of the just energy transition. We know that we were actually the first country to pilot the just energy transition, a program at a global level. But alongside that, we have made significant efforts towards improving the energy transition efforts of South Africa. We've gotten commitments and we've got projects that these commitments have been geared towards. We're going to get an update on where we stand from a just energy transition perspective, particularly looking at the portfolio management unit within the presidency that is responsible for these just energy transition initiatives. I'm joined on the line by the head of that project management unit for the just energy transition, Joanne Yawich, to take a look at the work that they are doing and where we are from a progress perspective. Joanne, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's do a bit of an overview of what it is that the project management unit within this particular current setup is responsible for.
Okay, thanks, Jimmy. Great to be talking to you and to your listeners. The JET Project Management Unit is a unit in the presidency, and it is responsible for essentially driving the implementation of the country's Just Energy Transition Investment Plan. That plan goes from 2023 to 2027. It's a five-year plan. And it looks at what would we need to do as a country to get ourselves onto a trajectory that would really drive a reduction in emissions and a diversification of the economy in order to achieve a green growth pathway within a diverse energy economy. So that is the work that we do. We work across government. We work with multiple government departments, all of whom have the just energy transition and supporting it as part of their mandate. And we essentially are responsible for mobilizing finance, for trying to ensure that that finance is deployed, and in particular for ensuring that it's done in a way that is just and inclusive, and that tries to ensure that we are very cognizant of the needs and interests and requirements of communities on the ground.
Speaking of those needs of communities, Joanne, can you give us a sense of the fundable projects that have been pipelined through the project management unit and just the scale of those projects in terms of the impact they'll be able to have on the South African people?
Okay, so we run a facility called a funding platform. It's not a fund. It is a matchmaking facility that tries to basically make it possible for community worker projects, SMME projects, to put in applications to this facility. and for the projects that are most deserving or most ready to then be funded by the various parties that support the Just Energy Transition Investment Plan. At the moment, we have 21 projects that are currently in our funding platform. Thus far, we've mobilized over 70 million rand from a blend of grant makers and investors, and they include a range of projects ranging from early childhood development centers in coal-affected communities to women and youth-led green economy SMMEs, and a range of other interventions. And what we have identified is that critical to all of this is to support these initiatives with a level of project preparation support that then makes them much more easily fundable.
Joanne, let's take a look at the funding side of it. Obviously, when dealing with these sorts of projects and projects of the size and scale, funding becomes critical, and I can imagine that is a huge part of why the platform exists in the first place, as you said, to match the right funders with the right sorts of projects. We've gotten from the European Union commitments. Initially, there was a commitment of 4.7 billion euros. Most recently as October this year, this month, there have been additional commitments of 12 billion euros over and above the initial commitments. So we've got just shy of 17 billion euros in financial commitments to support our green economy, to support the initiatives that we want to embark on as part of our just energy transition. How do these funds then get allocated? How do they get worked into the ecosystem? How do they then form part of the projects and potentially financing even bigger projects that we need as a country?
Okay, so the allocation of those funds is really the responsibility of the donors or the lenders in consultation with National Treasury and the government departments through which those funds are channeled. In the case of the EU, their latest through their Global Gateway Program, they are looking actually at three areas. The one is the just energy transition. The others are around supporting the critical minerals value chain in South Africa. And the third is really around supporting the building of a pharmaceutical industry in South Africa. So those funds go across a range of areas. Not all of them come and support the JET. The EU has been very important in supporting, in particular, SMME initiatives, quite a wide range of skills development initiatives in relation to the just energy transition, as well as providing significant technical assistance and capacity support right across the system from government departments through to research and other organizations, as well as support to the NGO community. So the donor countries, and I mean, in this partnership, there's also the UK, the Danish government, the Dutch government, the French and the German government, who've got longstanding programs in South Africa, and they try and allocate in alignment with the plan that the country has put on the table. For us, the priorities are really around, as I said, support to community and worker organizations on the ground, so supporting the just transition. Skills development is a priority for us. At a municipal level, we're working with SELGA on looking at how we can upgrade and modernize the distribution grid and the distribution infrastructure across the country. And then there is obviously the big issue of support to Eskom for transmission, as well as support as coal power plants get retired and Eskom builds its own renewables, support to that process going forward. So that gives you a sense of some of the areas that are priorities for us.
Building a supportive ecosystem in the just energy transition efforts of South Africa, that is part of what the project management unit is responsible for doing, alongside ensuring that these projects that we identify become bankable projects and fundable projects, and that they are funded. We're going to leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Joanne for those insights and for the time. The head of the Just Energy Transition Project Management Unit within the Presidency of South Africa, Joanne Jawich, to joining us to take a look at the progress that they've been making from a project perspective and what lies ahead for them.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And it's personal finance time on a Monday. We're going to be taking a look at managing your finances, particularly as a blended family. I'm joined on the line by a financial planner at BDO Wealth, Claire Steyn, to see what we make of this. Claire, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with what we mean by a blended family and perhaps why blended families have different financial conversations.
Sorry, Jimmy, can you just repeat that question? You broke up there slightly.
Sorry about that, Claire. I was just saying, let's start with the kind of definition of what a blended family is and why blended families typically have different financial conversations.
Great. The great question, Jimmy. I think, look, blended families can come in many, many forms, but primarily I think a blended family forms when two people, sort of each with children or financial responsibilities from previous relationships, come together and want to build a new life together. And obviously that can become quite complex. There's a lot of people in that relationship that need to be taken into account. And that's why the conversations are very different.
So Claire, what sorts of conversations are we having here? What sorts of conversations are blended families struggling with where it relates to financial histories, financial decisions, and everything of that sort?
So I think first and foremost, obviously, legal structuring, if they're entering into a new relationship together, are they planning on getting married again? Are they just going to cohabit together? The other big one is estate planning. The question that is so difficult to have but so important is, well, what happens, when you are no longer here? What happens to me? What happens, to my children, to your children, and everyone that's left behind? And that forms part of the estate planning discussion. And then obviously there's a lot that comes with that as well, protecting sort of, what you've built. We might bring in trust into the conversation for that. And we might also bring in a legal expert as well for that, to structure that for us.
Now, Claire, when we look at blended families and we look at some of the unique challenges that they are faced with, it starts to sound like there are certain fundamentals that need to be in place. I'm thinking of something like wills that relate to estate planning, knowing that that is a critical component where if there's a dispute between the new family, the old family, the extended family, the family's family, everybody can simply refer to one document. It clarifies where someone would have wanted their assets to be or how they would have wanted their assets to be distributed. Can we just go through some of the fundamentals that then become even more important in a blended family environment?
Well, I mean, you've touched on first and foremost, I think, yes, wills, making sure that your beneficiaries are up to date in terms of policies, risk planning in the event of something happening. What have you got in place for that? Who have you nominated as beneficiaries? What policies have you got in place? Looking just at the day-to-day finances, what have you got in place for the kids' education? Have we made provision for education funding across the different families? So many conversations, so many points that we can touch on. But I think first and foremost, it's actually just to have that sit down, Jimmy, and just to have that open and honest conversation albeit difficult, you know, to create that space to understand what is the actual goals now, you know, what are we working towards and how are we going to get there and what are we going to put in place to make sure that happens.
Claire, how do we have those conversations from a financial perspective, but also from an emotional perspective? I know there's a role that a financial advisor plays in all of this, but very often it can be a situation where someone feels that their family is not being prioritized or their children might not be prioritized, or you just simply have a scenario where because of the different age groups of different children, there's different financial obligations for each child across the family. How do we have the conversations without hurting the feelings and understanding that at the end of the day, this new family is all on the same team?
I think, Jimmy, for us at BDO Wealth Advisors, we firstly create that safe space. And when we enter into these conversations, these discussions with the various members within the family, first and foremost, they need to feel safe. So for that to happen, we make sure that we set out rules of engagement. You know, how are we going to coordinate these conversations to ensure that we respect each other while allowing for each person to be heard and to have their say, and to, you know, maybe when the emotions do become a bit heated, that we take a time out and we come back and we make sure that we all have on the same page and that we work towards the same goals. But it is you know, very difficult to, it's not easy conversations, but that's why having a financial guide there and an independent to sort of, you know, run these conversations is so important.
Claire, what if we can't agree on a financial strategy? I come into this relationship with my own strategy, my own financial advisor. It's been working for us. We've gone through what we've gone through. Someone else comes into the relationship with their own financial advisor and the same setup. How do we then come and find a middle ground and say, this is the strategy that works for our family, understanding that in some of those cases, we might not even be combining assets?
Jimmy, I think that's why we're having this conversation this evening, is to make people aware that it would be so valuable, whether you have your own financial guide or financial planner, you know, as a family unit and you're in a blended family, and whether the other part of that family has also their own financial guide. It's so important, if you are willing to try and have the conversations together, you know, to try and find some common ground, because you'll always be connected in some form or another. And, you know, if something were to happen in either or of the families, ultimately that guardianship for the children would then, you know, revert back to the other spouse. So it's so important to make sure that those goals carry through, especially when children are concerned, across all the family units.
Claire, how do we maintain the peace between the new family and the previous family? I mean, understanding that in some cases, the previous spouse might still be in the picture, who's still a parent to the children, and now the children now have their original parents, they now have step-parents and newer parents that come into the fold, but the decision-making from a financial perspective, how do you then have that take place without one party or one parent feeling like they're not being heard, or one child feeling like things are being imposed on them?
Sure, Jimmy, that's, again, it's tough, you know, but that's why it's important that each person have their say, you know, put on the table why they feel they're not being heard or where there's a mismatch, and then we see sort of how we can come to some sort of solution that would cater for everyone within the family unit. And sometimes, Jimmy, we don't always get to that. We agree to disagree, and you know, sometimes then to your point earlier, where some people are more comfortable to have their own financial planner for their unit, and you know, and vice versa. But ultimately, we've seen the benefits of having a financial guide across both family units and how much value this can add. And also incorporating the children into these conversations, you know, when as age appropriate as possible, to incorporate them into the conversation so they also understand, you know, sort of the impact that it has on the family.
Claire, do blended families carry increased levels of risk?
I think I wouldn't say increased levels of risk. not necessarily. I mean, you know, each family unit is different. I think they share a fair amount of risk. But again, it would depend on each person's specific scenario. You know, if there was a family business, for instance, I mean, there would be a lot more to be considered and possibly a lot more dynamics and a lot more things that would need to be sort of ironed out. But yeah, I think not necessarily more risk, but definitely a lot more discussion, a lot more open and honest conversations that would need to be had.
The considerations are different when dealing with blended families, especially when managing finances within these blended families. Speak to your financial advisor. They have your best interests at heart. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Claire for those insights and for the time. Claire Steyn, financial planner at BDO Wealth, joining us to take a look at financial planning and managing your finances as a blended family. It's just gone 7 o'clock. Greg Coast is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.